This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, my interview with Joel Derringer, founder of Slo County and DocuSupport, and author of a report on immigrants living on the Central Coast.
What we really wanted to do is just have some facts about who immigrants are in our county as opposed to conjecture.
Also, a story from UCSB student reporter Joyce Chi about what UCSB scientists think of President Trump's new restrictions on the National Institutes of Health.
This idea to just terminate all programs and funding related to diversity initiatives is unprecedented.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 3rd, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with music. Marisa Waddell, KCBX's program director, is in conversation with violinist Grace Seng, who is also Slo Symphony's music education manager.
The San Luis Obispo Symphony has a couple of concerts coming up this week. One is tonight. That's the Youth Symphony Concert at the Cuesta CPAC, featuring the winner of the Youth Symphony Concerto Competition. And the other is on Saturday at the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center. And that's the adult orchestra, the San Luis Obispo Symphony itself. My guest today is the symphony's music education manager. She sits in the first violin section of the symphony and conducts the preparatory strings, which is the beginning string ensemble for the youth symphony. Grace Seng, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here today.
Well, I'm happy that you were able to swing by. Grace, the San Luis Obispo Symphony has a long history of music education in our region. And in fact, I think it's about half of what the symphony does is education.
Yes, that's right. It's a large part of our mission. And the board is always very supportive of music education and making plans and designing our season.
Well, you came on board as music education manager in 2022. Give us a little bit of background about yourself personally and professionally, and tell us what prompted you to lead the education efforts of the Slo Symphony.
Sure. So I started playing the violin when I was 3 years old, and I studied violin in college and in grad school, and I've played with the Slo Symphony since 2003 when we moved here to San Luis Obispo. I also teach violin lessons and perform a lot in the community. I think I was prompted to step up for the Youth Symphony because of my own two kids who are studying violin as well. My daughter's in college now. My son's in high school, but I wanted to make sure that they both had a strong music education opportunities as I did when I was growing up.
Yeah. And boy, you've been playing in symphonies for a long, long time, since you
that's
were a kid.
Right.
You played in the Seattle Youth Symphony, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I started playing in the Seattle Youth Symphony in sixth grade. I grew up in Seattle, and that was a very important part of my musical development. And I had so much fun playing in Youth Symphony, and I knew that was something that I wanted to do.
Talk about the various performance groups that fall under the umbrella of the Youth Symphony in San Luis Obispo.
So the Youth Symphony has four different ensembles. Our top ensemble is the Concert Orchestra, and that's conducted by Christopher Woodruff. And then we have an intermediate strings group, Academy Strings, and that's conducted by Tanya Streeter. And our Symphonic Winds group is for our brass and woodwind intermediate students, and that's conducted by Al Streeter, Tanya's husband. And then I conduct the preparatory strings, which is the beginner group. And we have around 85 students total enrolled in all of the ensembles.
Wow. And so do any of the students who are in the concert orchestra also play in the San Luis Obispo Symphony, the adult orchestra?
Yes. Sometimes we do. Like, I know at our New Year's Eve concert, we had a cellist who is from the concert orchestra come and join us on stage. And we have a lot of alumni from the Youth Symphony that regularly play with the Slo Symphony.
I know that the soloist who's going to be playing as a part of the concert tonight, the Youth Symphony Concerto Competition winner, she is one of the Shank kids, and I know the Shank family has a long tradition of high performance in classical music on the Central Coast. Tell me a little bit about her and about what we can expect tonight from what she's going to be playing, the Haydn Concerto, right?
That's right, yes. So Emerald is the youngest of the 9 kids in their family, and she plays violin in the concert orchestra, and she's also a cello coach with the preparatory strings, which with my group, but she won the concerto competition playing the piano. So she is quite an accomplished musician, as all her siblings are. And we have always several of her brothers playing in the Slow Symphony and helping in different ways. They're very active in the music community here. And her piece is very challenging, and she plays it from memory, and it's just going to be a wonderful performance tonight.
It just must be a thrill to be a young person standing in front of an orchestra playing a big, beautiful work like that. And the competition scene, is that something that you participated in growing up?
Yes.
Tell me what that's like.
Well, you prepare and prepare, and then, you know, you do your best, and then sometimes get adjudicated for notes, or there's sometimes prizes or opportunities to perform. But it's a different aspect of music than the art. So it's kind of like on one side, you're being judged technically, and then on the other side, you're trying to create something artistic and meaningful. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and it certainly gives you an opportunity to play as a soloist in front of a large orchestra.
That's right.
Which is a great experience,
right.
I expect.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the work that the San Luis Obispo Symphony does in the schools on the Central Coast.
Sure. So we have several programs that go to the schools. One is our Music Van program, or Instrument Petting Zoo, and we bring instruments to different schools or libraries around the county and give a brief presentation about the instruments, and then allow students to come and try out the instruments for themselves. And they can try violins, violas, cellos, flutes, clarinets, French horns, trumpets, trombones, and we have a disinfecting system for everything that touches your mouth and all the percussion instruments, and they have a great time being able to make a sound on instruments, usually for the first time. We also have some beginning strings classes that meet after school several days a week, and that's an opportunity for students to learn violin or cello, and they do that for a full year, so they're able to learn quite a bit.
And is that in all of the schools on the Central Coast?
No, right now we only have it at Baywood and at Bellevue Santa Fe. So it's only at certain schools. Mm-hmm. And we also have that same class in the Summer Experience Program with the San Luis Coastal School District. So that's one of the elective options for summer students to learn beginning violin or cello.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a string quartet that travels to different schools and performs a program of California mission music.
Oh, wow.
So that is usually for a large assembly, and we perform music that was written in the 1700s, like when the missions were being built and performed at that time. And then,
is that music that was unearthed by Craig Russell?
Exactly. Definitely. It was Dr. Russell's research. So it's quite beautiful music, minuets, and it sounds like stuff Mozart would have written, or, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of, it's like a classical sounding, but there's definitely some Spanish flavor to it, fandangos and things like that. So it's fun to be able to talk to the students about the music that was going on, especially if they are studying the missions as part of their fourth grade curriculum.
Uh-huh. And who all is in that ensemble that travels around?
Yeah, I play, and then Jeanette Wrights and Karen Louie Jones and Ken Husted are
the others. Yeah, that's a nice group.
Yes.
And what else are you doing in the schools?
Those would be our three main school programs. And then we offer our no ties free dress rehearsals as an opportunity to invite students and families to come watch the Slow Symphony perform for free. the no ties are at 11 o'clock at the PAC when we have a dress rehearsal.
So this Saturday at 11.
Yes.
Families can just head on down to the PAC.
That's right. You can come in for free at 11 o'clock. We'll have the petting zoo set up in the lobby. And it's just a great way for students and families to come see the orchestra and experience an orchestra concert for free.
I love that you call it the Instrument Petting Zoo. It's such a great name for it because it really seems like it encourages hands-on.
Exactly. Yeah, those instruments are well-loved and they're meant to be picked up and tried. So,
are you ever looking for instruments to be donated to the petting zoo or as performance instruments for
yes.
students?
Yeah, we're always happy to take instruments that people are no longer using, especially string instruments. We can always use them for our after-school programs. Even wind and brass instruments, we can use them in our petting zoo. So we're always open to instrument donations. If you have any laying around your closet or attic that are not being used, we'd love to take them and put them back to good use.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest today is Grace Seng, who is Violin 1 for the San Luis Obispo Symphony, and she's also the symphony's music education manager. We're talking about the San Luis Obispo Symphony's music education programs and also the concerts that are coming up. One is tonight, and that is the Youth Symphony Concert at the Cuesta CPAC. And what time does that start, Grace?
6:30 p.m.
6:30 tonight at Cuesta CPAC to see the Youth Symphony and its various ensembles. And then the other one is this coming Saturday, and that is the Classical Hits, Schubert, Tchaikovsky, and Beethoven, performed by the San Luis Obispo Symphony, the Adult Orchestra, and that's at the Performing Arts Center in San Luis Obispo. So back to the San Luis Obispo Symphony's education program. You were talking about some things that are available on Saturday, the petting zoo, the no ties allowed. Anything else going on this Saturday?
Our youth symphony performs in the lobby before the concerts. So on Saturday, the concert is at 7:30, but from 7 o'clock, if you come early, you can come into the lobby and watch one of our youth symphony ensembles perform for about 10 to 15 minutes. So this Saturday will feature the Symphonic Winds with Al Streeter. And our next concert in March will feature the Academy Strings with Tanya Streeter. And in May, it will feature the Preparatory Strings with me. So if you do come to this Low Symphony concert, make sure you come early to catch those brief performances by the Youth Symphony. And then the students are always invited to stay for the concert at 7:30. We offer them comp tickets so that they're able to come and see an evening performance and watch their teachers on stage and just be part of the whole symphonic experience.
Do you have a specific story about how your education programs have affected a child or a family in a positive way?
Yeah, so many of our students, especially the ones who come through the Youth Symphony, they really take that, it really grabs them, and they're able to take that love of music on for the rest of their lives and study it in college. And we have one alumni of the Youth Symphony, Hannah Thompson, who went all through the Youth Symphony program, and she studied music and English in college, and now she's back and working as a coach in the Youth Symphony and also performing in the Slow Symphony. So, and we have many people in the Slow Symphony who have come up through the Youth Symphony and just gone on to have music as a part of their lives that carries through.
Let's talk about the concert tonight. It features all of the various ensembles in the Youth Symphony, right?
That's right.
Tell me what we can expect this evening.
So each group will play three or four short pieces. We do have one piece that combines the Academy Strings and Symphonic Winds. So that's always really exciting for those wind and string players to come together and experience the full orchestra. We try to have one or two pieces each concert that allows them to combine. The concert orchestra will be playing Slavonic Dance by Dvorak, Slavonic Dance number 8, and also Bacchanal from Samson and Delilah by Saint-Saëns. And those are both before the Haydn Piano Concerto.
Yeah, those are both really exciting upbeat, fun pieces, aren't they?
Yes, it's a nice variety of music for sure.
Yeah, and again, Emerald Shanks will be the soloist on the Haydn Concerto for Piano and Orchestra in D, and she's the winner of the San Luis Obispo Youth Symphony Concerto competition. Wonderful opportunity for a student to perform solo in front of an orchestra. And by the way, that is tonight at 6:30 at the Cuesta College CPAC.
Right.
And then this Saturday, tell me what we can expect for the San Luis Obispo Symphony Concert.
Sure. So this Saturday, our program does not have a soloist. It kind of features the orchestra instead. So we're playing Romeo and Juliet by Tchaikovsky and Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral, and Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. And those are all just great masterworks and well-loved. And I know, speaking for the musicians, we're all very excited to play this program. It's all music that we've grown up with, and it's always so special to be able to perform that music and bring it to life and play it with your friends and your colleagues and just bring it to the community.
It's the kind of concert where everyone in the audience is going to go home humming, because these tunes you already know. So many people have grown up listening to Schubert's Unfinished and Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet and Beethoven's Sixth. The Pastoral Symphony by Beethoven is just so lush and gorgeous.
Yes.
And it's the Pastoral Symphony is something that really encapsulates what it feels and sounds like, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it definitely paints a picture of beautiful nature and storms and just, I mean, you can picture that Fantasia movie.
Yeah.
With the unicorns, but
but
it's really fun music to play. Just beautiful.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point about, you know, picturing Fantasia and the unicorns. That's how so many of us connect with classical music initially, is as children watching cartoons.
That's right.
Because it is so often a part of cartoons, is this beautiful chamber music or orchestral music. And even now video games, too, with orchestral music written specifically for the video games. It's a door to a whole world of concert music.
Right.
Tell me about what you love about any of the pieces that are coming up on Saturday.
Well, they're all really fun to play. The violins always get a really good part in all of that music. So I definitely am looking forward to just being able to play all those beautiful melodies, especially in Romeo and Juliet. And my favorite movement probably on the program is the second movement of the Schubert Unfinished. It's just so simple, but so beautiful to play. And so I'm really looking forward to that movement in particular.
Oh, well, I'm sure that it's going to be a lovely concert. It's definitely a romantic concert with the early romantic music all the way up until the full Tchaikovsky romanticism.
Right.
And I think Classical Hits is a great name for it. If somebody wants to buy tickets either for the concert tonight or for the Saturday concert, how does one do that?
So for the Youth Symphony concert, you can go to the CPAC website, or you can just come to the ticket box office. Tickets are $15 for adults for the Youth Symphony. For the Saturday concert, a Slow Symphony, you go through paxslow.org, or you can come to the Slow Symphony website, and you should be able to find ticket links easily through our website. It's slowsymphony.org.
And are you ever looking for volunteers or donations in any kind of way?
Yes, we always welcome volunteers, especially if you're interested in doing the instrument petting zoo. You don't have to have any musical experience to be part of that. But if you have time, especially during the day or the weekends even, we would love to have you come and help just kind of manage the instruments. And having more adults there always makes it run smoothly and more fun for the kids to have more opportunities to play more instruments. So we always are looking for volunteers for Petting Zoo. And also, I think if you are interested in volunteering for the Slow Symphony, you can contact our office info at slowsymphony.org, and we'd love to match up your interests and skills to our opportunities.
And you can donate there when you're on that website too, right?
That's right. You're always happy to accept donations.
Well, Grace Seng, thank you so much for joining me. Grace Seng is the music education manager for the San Luis Obispo Symphony and the conductor of the preparatory strings. She also plays in the first violin section for the San Luis Obispo Symphony. And again, there are concerts tonight. That's the Youth Symphony concert this evening starting at 6:30 at the Cuesta CPAC. And then on Saturday, starting at 7:30, it's the San Luis Obispo Symphony concert at the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center. And go early.
Yes.
So that you can catch some members of the Youth Symphony playing beforehand.
Right.
Thank you so much, Grace, for coming and joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Absolutely.
I'm Marisa Waddell for Issues and Ideas.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next, Sam DJ, programming intern at KCBX, speaks to Mary Matakovich, who has been involved with the Martin Luther King Jr. High School Memorial Scholarship Fund since 1982. The fund's big fundraiser is coming up this Sunday on February 9th.
Hello. My guest today is Mary Matakovich, president of the board of the Martin Luther King Jr. High School Memorial Scholarship Fund. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you for allowing me to come and talk about our great organization.
So tell me a little bit more about your scholarship fund.
The Martin Luther King Jr. High School Memorial Scholarship Fund was created right after Martin Luther was assassinated. And what happened in our town here was strong concern for how to handle such a tragic event. Jenny Hiltel, who is a member of the community, along with several community members, went to San Luis High to meet with Rusty Duvall, who is the principal at the time. And they talked about what would be a good way to deal with this, especially with the students at the high school. They formed a steering committee, and that steering committee, with the student body leadership, came up with the idea of a memorial scholarship in honor of Martin Luther. And so our first scholarship was given in 1969 to Liz Lewis. And from there, the group expanded to include students at besides San Luis High School, also Mission College Prep and Pacific Beach High School. And what's remarkable is we have existed, we're now in our 56th year of providing scholarships to students at those three high schools. And it's amazing to be part of this organization because it was a grassroots effort to deal with a great tragedy.
And how did you get involved with the organization?
Well, I was lucky enough to become the principal of San Luis High School in 1982. And so I became familiar with all of the scholarships that are available to students at the school. And this one in particular was interest of mine. So I attended the annual fundraiser and washed dishes and set tables and helped clean up for a few years. And then the board asked me if I would participate on the board. And I was honored to serve as an associate for several years and then as a member of the board.
So tell me more about the actual day-to-day operations of the fund.
Well, our fund committee meets monthly. And we plan our strategies for raising funds, and that's kind of the key to what we're all about, as well as how we go through the scholarship process of interviewing students. And that is a pretty involved process. But more importantly, since our goal is to raise funds, maybe if I could say how we go about doing that. Basically, all money raised is divided by $1,500, and that gives us the number of scholarships that we're able to raise money for. We hold back a couple thousand dollars for the next year, but honestly, all the money that we raise annually goes into these scholarships. As well, we have donors that give annually. We also have a bank of sustaining donors of over 80 people who continue to support us year after year. It's a challenge each year to come up with a way to get to more people in the community, and this has been one way to be able to allow us to talk about our event on your station.
Does the fund have any upcoming events?
We have our barbecue on February 9th, Super Bowl Sunday from 12 to 3 at the Elks Lodge on Elks Lane, and that's where we sell dinner tickets at $15 a piece. And all proceeds go to supporting our scholarship fund. We are an all-volunteer organization, and we think it's important any money raised goes directly to students. We started with one scholarship, and now we are up to 17 at $1,500 a piece, and we're very proud to keep growing our organization in order to support more students. So back to the breakfast. I didn't mention that it's a chicken barbecue, potato salad, beans, garlic bread, and desserts. So you get the works when you come to our breakfast. You're also able to take out meals, which a lot of people do to support their Super Bowl activity, or you can eat in and enjoy the atmosphere of the Elks. And look at our memorabilia. We have scrapbooks from all of the years that we've been involved. And it's just a good community builder to be able to bring the community together in honor of Martin Luther.
Have there been any meaningful moments in your work with the fund or any challenges that you faced?
Well, this is one of the most rewarding opportunities that I've had as a member of the public and as a public school employee, to realize that the communities come together to raise money, to go directly to students and to support them with their potential career opportunity. It isn't just for students who are going on to college. We have students that go into technical training, cosmetology, a lot of different pathways for a career. And what's most significant to me is to serve on the interview panels. We have separate teams that go out to each of the three high schools. And what we look for in our students is an attitude of confidence and willingness to share their goals and their dreams, willingness to share what they've accomplished over their school careers, the tragedies where they've been resilient and focused on what their goals are, and especially their response to Martin Luther and what his message was of peace and bringing the community together. That's the most inspirational part of this work. I need to mention that this scholarship also is given to students who have a definite focus and goal for their future after high school. We also look at need of each student to ensure that it's important to them to have the support in order to make their next step. And we are also looking for students who have a good scholarship record. Usually we have more students than we're able to accommodate because there is a big need for students to have support in what they're going to accomplish. So we just strive to get donations and to get the support of the community to get behind these students and to help them with their next steps. What's neat is to have the barbecue and to realize that the people there are past families that we've supported, past students that have realized their goals.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Sam DJ with Mary Matakovich of the MLK Jr. High School Memorial Scholarship Fund. From your own perspective, working with the fund, what is the impact that you've seen it have on the Central Coast community?
Well, I think that what this scholarship has done is brought together the community with the high school students and allowing the high school students to benefit from the professionalism of the community members who sponsor the scholarship.
You talked a little bit about what sorts of schools the scholarship students go on to attend. Have any come back and shared their story of success with you?
Oh, very, very good. Yes, just by their presence coming back to the barbecue, we have tales about students graduating from college, graduating from cosmetology school, going to Arizona to a technical training institute, and they're so proud of themselves, and they realize that with that extra bit of support, they were able to take the next step and be successful in what they planned as their goal. And what's interesting is these students aren't necessarily the students that would ask for anything in order to realize their goals. And it's difficult for some of them to fill out an application and lay out their plans and ask for financial support. And it's a real good life lesson to know that if you ask and have a meaningful goal, that people will support you. And so by their families coming back to the barbecue and by their presence at the barbecue and volunteering to help us out, it's what makes the difference.
And aside from financial assistance, is there any other support that you give your scholarship students?
Well, I think that just by going through a process of filling out an application, identifying the important pieces of the application, which gives a profile of their family, their financial needs, their goals, and also how they relate to Dr. King. They talk about how he has had an impact on how they view the world. You know, he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and he also was very active in the community in sending a message of solidarity across the board at all levels of the community. So they learn how important it is to have a meaningful life with a commitment to making things better. So all I can say is I think besides participating in the barbecue, the application process, the interview process, and then being able to receive the award, we have a breakfast for our awardees and they bring their families and they speak to how this is going to make a difference in their lives. And we are just grateful that they've chosen to participate in our process.
Do you have any vision for the future of the fund?
Well, growing as, you know, being able to raise more money to be able to provide more scholarships and to be able to reach out. We've accepted all volunteers who want to participate with us on the fundraiser and certainly on the interview process. So all we can do is maintain and improve on what we're already doing.
And how can community members who want to get involved with the fund contact you?
Well, we have a website, mlk.org, and from there you can see the ways in which you can contribute your time, talent, and funds.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, just that this has been a wonderful part of my life here in San Luis Obispo, over 40 years of participating in this type of event. And I want to thank the community for their ongoing support. As well, we have included Cal Poly Sorority, Chi Delta Theta, as well as Latinos in Agriculture. I mentioned the Elks Lodge as being gracious to host us, the Diversity Coalition in San Luis Obispo, Renata Campbell and her photography, the NAACP, and we have a special person in Jerry Lenthal who has been instrumental in selling a lot of tickets to this event. So this makes it very special for our students, and we appreciate that opportunity.
Thanks for talking with me, Mary.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Sam DJ, programming intern at KCBX. Mary Matakovich is president of the board of the Martin Luther King Jr. High School Memorial Scholarship Fund. Don't miss their chicken barbecue fundraiser coming up on February 9th at the Elks Lodge in SLO. Check out their website at mlkfund.org.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Mayor Ali. Up next, Joel Duringer, one of the founding members of the nonprofit SLO County UndocuSupport, talks about his new report on Central Coast immigrants that includes data on undocumented immigrants that was sourced from the Migration Policy Institute and the USC Immigrant Data Portal. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
So, tell us a little bit about SLO County UndocuSupport, and how does this report tie into the work that you do?
SLO County UndocuSupport was founded during the COVID crisis through a group of volunteers and community activists, recognizing that undocumented members of the community were systematically and emphatically left out of support systems during COVID. There was specific federal legislation that excluded undocumented from receiving benefits like the payments that were provided to everyone. So we locally came together, raised funds from several hundred local contributions to provide aid and assistance directly to undocumented members of our community. And over time, the program, SLO County UndocuSupport, has been adopted and become a program of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County.
And so how does this report tie into the work that the nonprofit is doing?
Well, when we first started doing it, one of the biggest questions was, how many undocumented people do we have in the county? And at that time, we were relying on some very old data and had an estimate of perhaps 9,000. So this report actually delves a lot deeper, not only into the undocumented population, but the diversity of the immigrant population, to really understand where people come from, who they are, and looking at some specific populations, breaking them down. It also looks at the history of immigration throughout the county, because the reality is, if you're not a member of the Chumash Nation or one of the other indigenous nations here, we're all immigrants. So there's just been waves of immigrants at different times, and we wanted to understand who they were over time and who's here now. So it's really much more of a report looking at immigrants in our county rather than the immigration system or the border issues.
So why did you decide to specifically research on immigrants living in SLO County?
Well, I've been active in working with immigrant and farm worker for most of my professional career. Started out in law school at UC Davis working on major litigation on farm worker issues and continued doing so. I was an attorney at California Rural Legal Assistance here in San Luis Obispo, mm-hmm. which specifically represents both rural and farm worker populations. So I've been engaged in this work for quite a bit of time.
Did you feel like maybe there was a lack of data? As you mentioned earlier, is that what prompted you to start collecting this data on immigrants?
So there's definitely a lack of data. And what we really wanted to do is just have some facts. So for the most part, this report is a data report on the entire immigrant population. And it's not magic in finding these data. A lot of it is census data. Much of it has been in other local reports. But it was compiling it into one place where we have a sort of a compendium of data on the immigrant population. And it really is to sort of ground ourselves in the facts about who immigrants are in our county as opposed to conjecture.
And is there like a timeline, like a starting point from where you've taken the data of immigrants?
Well, most of the data that we use is the most current. It's actually from the census, the American Community Survey, through 2022. So we don't have actually the most current information, but we have the most current data that's available. And we're pretty much looking at the current time. We also looked at some trends over time to see, in a way, what percent of the population has been immigrants. And it's dropping a little bit at this point.
Oh, okay. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, for one thing, there's been a lot more border enforcement. So people coming in, immigrating, have been a lot lower. I think there's also immigrants who've come here are now settled out and have families. So most of the immigrants in our county have been here a long time. I think most are well over 15 years, if not more. And the other thing is half of the immigrants in the county are actually U.S. citizens. So they've been here long enough to become naturalized.
That was one of your key findings. What were some other ones that you can share with us? And what was one finding that you were personally surprised by?
So some of the findings is looking at where immigrants come from in this county. So those of us who typically think, oh, they're Latino immigrants. And the fact is probably just under half of immigrants don't come from Latin America. So they're from all over the world. They're from Asia. They're from Europe. We know we have Canadians as well who would be immigrants here. So that was one thing, is to really point out what the diversity of the population is. I think the most interesting fact is when we also confuse a lot of populations and sort of meld them together and we say, oh, the Latinos are all immigrants. Well, the fact is 80% of Latinos in the county were born in the country. So there have been immigrants from Mexico since the missionary times. So it's actually a much longer population living here. And that's what was interesting, is to see that 80% were actually born here.
You also spoke in your report about some of the barriers that immigrant communities face, such as wage disparities, problems with housing, difficulty accessing healthcare. Can you share a little bit more about those barriers?
One of the biggest barriers actually has to do with language. And it's being able to access and feel comfortable with services and have people that speak your language. And while we do have a fair amount of Spanish language services, there are many immigrants who don't speak Spanish, even from Mexico. So there are those who speak Mixteco or Zapotec that don't know Spanish. So it becomes a much bigger barrier when you don't speak the language. And that also leads to a lot of distrust in institutions and a lot of miscommunication. So the food bank did a survey of food bank recipients 2 years ago, and about half of those were in Spanish. But what we learned from that is that the Spanish-speaking, the Latino population, really is reluctant to use food bank services because they don't feel comfortable there. There's no one who speaks their language at some of the food distributions. There's no one who looks like them. So I know, for instance, that report made a lot of impact because the food bank has really worked a lot more with some immigrant organizations to enhance the sort of acceptance of the programs.
And in your report, you talk about the immigrant community in Slo County, but the immigrant community, as you yourself said, is so diverse. Was there a difference in findings between immigrants and then those immigrants who were not documented?
Well, what we were able to do is look at those immigrants who are now citizens who've become naturalized and those who are non-citizens. So the census doesn't actually break out who's undocumented. The numbers we have on the undocumented population come from sort of statistical machinations, in a way, by some researchers looking at some of the census data and then coming up with an estimate of undocumented. So we were able to look at those who are citizens who probably have been here longer and those who are non-citizens. So educational attainment is much lower for non-citizens, much of that having to do with lack of opportunity in their home country. The economic status, they're mostly in low-wage jobs, and in our county it's typically agriculture, construction, or hospitality. The burdens of rent are much higher for non-citizen populations.
So just to clarify, it's more that the disparities between citizens who are immigrants and non-citizens, not necessarily people who are undocumented.
Well, there are other disparities that affect the undocumented, and those actually have to do with legal barriers on top of all the language barriers and cultural barriers.
But what I mean is, in this report, it was more that it was citizens versus non-citizens,
right,
as opposed to...
because that's the census data that we used.
Yeah. And the census doesn't count undocumented.
No. But, you know, I can tell you that the undocumented face even higher burdens. They're specifically excluded from many programs, whether it's food stamps. And interestingly, undocumented workers who work contribute into the Social Security system and in a way subsidize it, but can't draw down the benefits. And it's the same thing with unemployment insurance. So you're not eligible for unemployment insurance, even though it's taken out of your paycheck.
Any plans of doing another report that specifically focuses on undocumented immigrants in Slo County?
Well, I think we've probably incorporated data-wise, probably not, because we'd have to actually go out and do surveys of that. But we have a lot of information from the undocumented community through focus groups that UndocuSupport support, hosted in the past several years, working with Spanish-speaking and even Mixteco-speaking populations to understand what their issues are. And typically, it's, you know, the same issues of housing, healthcare, education, and income, and language, you know, being the biggest barrier.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking to Joel Derringer, one of the founders of the nonprofit Slo County UndocuSupport, and the author of a report on the immigrant community in Slo County. How do you hope that this data will serve the community in Slo?
Well, I think right now with all of the anti-immigrant rhetoric, I think it really helps in understanding who immigrants are. It's not one population, it's many. It also helps us understand the benefit of the immigrant population here to our industries, to ag, to construction, to hospitality. For instance, nearly all farm workers are immigrants, half of whom are undocumented. Among people in the food service industry, maybe 6 in 10 cooks are Latino immigrants. Same thing in childcare. Mm-hmm. So whenever we start looking at, you know, saying, oh, we're going to evict all these people or deport them, mm-hmm. there's going to be a big hole in the economic workforce in the county.
So your report was released January 14th. What has been the media and community response?
Well, the media, I mean, there was an article in the Tribune, mm-hmm. a very good summary, probably a better one than I could have written, that came out, I think, within 2 days of the report. So that was very good. And there's been follow-up looking at what the new presidential administration, how that may impact immigrants in the county. We're certainly doing the show on KCBX. I just got a email about KSBY wanting to do something. We've also used it to host a meeting yesterday of a coalition of immigrant advocates and serving organizations. And we had over 50 people from 30 different agencies coming together to try and figure out what is the adequate response to support the immigrant community in these upcoming times.
And the report initiated that kind of meeting, or was connected to it?
I was certainly connected to it. It helps, as I said, ground some of these people with facts, but it's been part of a much larger UndocuSupport effort over the last several years to have much more awareness of the immigrant and undocumented population and how to support them.
How long did it take you to research and write this report?
Oh, it's probably been a 6-month process. Okay. It was about a year ago that we started talking about it, but then it was a matter of putting together. We have a diversity of funders. We have mm-hmm. the Community Foundation, MUST Charities in the North County, the First Five Commission, the Diversity Coalition, and then also funding from the County Board of Supervisors.
So what is the next step? You mentioned this meeting that's happening. In addition to that, how do you plan on building on the data that you found?
Well, I think it's actually... the coalition is using the data in terms of communications our coalition is looking at a lot of how do we work with the immigrant population and letting them know their rights and educating them about what services they can access, how they can feel safe, although I'm not sure that we'll be able to do that well, but also what their rights are. And the data helps in the communication and understanding who sort of the diversity of the population is, that when we start talking about, oh, we're going to deport all immigrants, well, you can't. Many of them are citizens. So It really is providing a broader perspective on it.
Have immigrants seen this report? What has been their response if you've shared it with them?
Well, I've shared it in the organizations. It just came out, So we haven't really been on the road. Mm-hmm. I presented the findings first public meeting to the first five commission. We've talked about having convenings around the county with the community, both talk about the report, but also the implications of it.
Can you talk to us a little bit about specifically the data that you found?
Yes. So the overall immigrant population is about 10% of our county, 26,000. Perhaps half or more of those are actually U.S. citizens. Separate data, not census data, we've estimated there are about 7,000 to 8,000 undocumented residents in the county. Now, they also live in families, and mixed status families, as we say, that have citizens and legal permanent residents. So there's over 16,000 residents in the county who are either undocumented or live with an undocumented individual. And also for Latino children, at least a quarter have one or more undocumented parents. So, you know, when we talk about deportation, the impact is going to be on entire families and social systems. And so it's going to really ripple throughout the community.
Well, thank you, Joel, for your time. And we really appreciate this report because, as you said, it fills a huge gap in the data that exists on immigrants living in Slo County. So thank you.
Yeah, it was exciting to do it and exciting to talk about it. So thank you.
That was Joel Dieringer from Slo County on DocuSupport. His report on immigrants living on the Central Coast was published on January 14th and is available at the Community Foundation's website at www.cfsloco.org under News and Events. Next, we have a story about UCSB scientists and how they think President Trump's restrictions on the National Institutes of Health will impact their research, by UCSB student reporter Joyce Chi.
In the United States, health and science are overseen by the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS. It covers many agencies, like the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. Last week, on January 21st, the Trump administration delivered some major changes to these HHS sub-agencies. In line with President Donald Trump's crusade against so-called quote-unquote radical and wasteful government DEI programs, web pages about structural racism and diversity seem to have been taken down from the NIH. That includes information about applying for diversity supplements, which supports new researchers with funding and mentorship. Another major directive from the Trump administration to these health agencies was to pause all external communications. The Washington Post explains this includes public health advisories, website and social media updates, weekly scientific reports sent out to medical providers, and more. This pause lasts until at least February 1st, and quote-unquote mission-critical exceptions for the communications pause must be approved by Trump appointees. Now, this is not all that unusual, but previous communication pauses during presidential transitions have only lasted one day, not 11. The pause also makes it difficult to recruit patients into clinical research trials and to know for certain if NIH researchers can still submit papers to scientific journals. Stephanie Speer, an HHS spokesperson and longtime ally of HHS Secretary nominee RFK Jr., said that this, quote, short pause allows the new team to set up a process for review and prioritization, end quote. But the new administration imposed other restrictions, too. Besides the pause on external communications, the NIH was also met with a temporary freeze on hiring, travel, and grant reviews. The hiring freeze is government-wide, but Science Magazine says only the HHS is under the communications and travel pause. Nature Magazine explains that as part of the restrictions, the NIH, the largest public funder of biomedical and behavioral research, also cannot give out research grant funding, leaving 80% of its $47 billion budget in limbo. Why? Well, grant reviews are done through study sections, groups of 20 to 50 experts who look over and score similarly themed grant proposals.
That's the role of these study sections, is to make sure that we provide the government the best advice we can to spend tax dollars efficiently.
That's Dr. Tommy Sprigg, a professor in the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at UCSB. Not only is his lab funded by the NIH, Sprigg is also a member of the Human Complex Mental Function Study Section. After a study section, an advisory council aggregates and approves the scores before grants are awarded. It appears that grant review panels scheduled before February 2nd were canceled. It takes time to plan these review panels that also require 40 to 60 hours of preparation, which is why experts are worried that it'll take months to get back to normal. So what do all these pauses mean for researchers at NIH, but also here at UC Santa Barbara, many of whom get funding from the NIH to support their work? Here's Dr. Karen Zumlinski, another neuroscientist and professor here at UCSB.
So the NIH funding is absolutely critical for the research that I do, and I cannot do the research without NIH funding. And that's primarily because I conduct biomedical research in my laboratory focused on the neurobiology of addictive disorders and related comorbid disorders like anxiety and depression. And the NIH is the main funding source of biomedical research within the United States. And while some small projects in my lab can be funded by, say, small grants from the university, the amount of money in these grants is really only sufficient to cover a tiny fraction of the research expenses. So the majority of research expenses in my lab require large sums of money, which I apply for through the NIH.
Zumlinski said she's received both small and large grants from the NIH for the past 25 years. And from her experience, what's happening now is out of the ordinary.
What we're seeing right now is completely and utterly different. So as you can imagine, with new presidents come different foci of research interests. So there was a turn towards COVID-related research to tackle, you know, the major public health issues during any president's term. So fentanyl is big right now. So a big focus on opioid addiction. This makes sense. You target the money based on public health needs and public health concerns and emerging public health concerns. What is occurring right now? This idea to just simply terminate all programs and funding related to diversity initiatives, and currently right now to completely shut down all communications and meetings related to NIH activity is unprecedented.
Here's Dr. Sprigg again.
Disruptions in funding mean people lose jobs. Active projects have to be paused. The discoveries that make U.S. science so amazing will not happen as quickly or efficiently or maybe at all the way that we all hope they do.
Dr. Zumlinski said the freezes are especially stagnating for these scientists who are so new to their career, leaving them without money they need to advance.
I'm planning on retiring at some point within the next 15 years. Who's going to take my place if there isn't funding to support the younger generation, the next generation of scientists?
Some of these emerging scientists also rely on the additional grants that support people from marginalized backgrounds. Information about the applications for these grants have been removed from the NIH website, seemingly in line with Trump's crusade against DEI.
These additional training grants are there to help provide additional support to folks who might not have had the opportunities that other students might have had. I find this particularly ironic, given that the current president would like to make America healthy again. It's kind of hard to do that if you're forcing all of the scientists to struggle to conduct their research.
With KCSB News, I'm Joyce Chi.
You've been been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.